human beings are designed to move in a variety of ways, engaging with an unpredictable, changing world around us, and that in our modern life, we tend to get stuck in the same patterns, whether it's more sedentary patterns or movement patterns. And in the yoga world, there is so much variety and self-reflection and learning what it means to feel connected to your body. And I also see that that can at some point create some patterns. And so I'm very passionate in embodied yoga practice to shake things up and bring other types of movement that are good for us in the modern day into the practice.
Welcome to Your Inner Radiance, your new go-to for self-love practices, yoga lifestyle inspiration, and Ayurvedic tips to support you to uncover your inner radiance. Today on the podcast, I have a special guest for you, Michelle Nayeli Bouvier, and I think you'll really be inspired to hear her speak about movement and embodiment and yoga and new ways that modern science meets ancient teachings, new ways of understanding the most healthy and resilient and natural ways to move. So let me tell you a little bit about Michelle. She is a multidisciplinary movement specialist, yoga therapist, teacher, trainer, and creator of the cutting-edge Kutila School of Embodied Resilience. Always a daring trailblazer, Michelle trains the next generation of yoga and movement teachers to break free of rigid, linear paradigms of movement, thought, and leadership as a path to transform lives and change the world. Rooted in passionate, continuing study of ancient teachings meeting modern science, Michelle's decades of experience and groundbreaking work are helping lead the evolution of integrative embodied practice for personal and collective resilience.
Welcome, Michelle, to the Your Inner Radiance podcast.
Hi, Lily. Thanks for having me.
Yay. I'm so glad we're making this happen. I'm so excited to get to chat with you about topics about yoga and embodiment and some of your contributions to at least my evolution in terms of movement. And so I guess the first question I want to ask you is, what are you most passionate about as a movement educator?
Thanks, Lily, for that. I'm so happy to have sprinkled a little magic on you. What I'm most passionate about is that movement is life itself, and human beings are designed to move in a variety of ways, engaging with an unpredictable, changing world around us, and that in our modern life, we tend to get stuck in the same patterns, whether it's more sedentary patterns or movement patterns. And as you know, I've been teaching embodied yoga for a long time now. And in the yoga world, there is so much variety and self-reflection and learning what it means to feel connected to your body. And I also see that that can at some point create some patterns. And so I'm very passionate in embodied yoga practice to shake things up and bring other types of movement that are good for us in the modern day into the practice.
Yeah. So that's one of the things I love about your trainings and your movement practices that I've done with you is that there's so much variety and it's so fun because it's so out of the box. And it feels so good, and it feels like such a creative but also very intentional step in this new direction in the world of movement and yoga, at least in modern times. And I guess I'm curious then, because you've been a yoga teacher for so long and you're so versed in the body and the ways of moving intelligently, and that's like something we share with pranavinyasa yoga. What can you speak to when we think about yoga and how, and maybe not even just yoga, but all the types of intentional movement that are practiced these days, like what are some of the common trends and patterns that you're seeing that have made you kind of reflect on and create the offerings that you offer that bring in all of this variety and new patterning? Like, what are the trends that we see that kind of have created maybe unhealthy patterns that it's time to become aware of?
I am really fascinated with how things shift. I know for myself, I've been practicing yoga for about 30 years now and went through many different schools, and this is less common now, but it's still around. I experienced very strict rules of alignment that were about placing the body into shapes from the outside versus from the inside. And that becomes movement dictated by our brain and our cognitive mind rather than the wisdom inherent inside the body. Another thing that I see more today, maybe not more, but where I live, very, very popular today, is moving really, really fast, which I have no problem with moving fast, but there can be more vulnerability to injury if you just have people walking off the street into a class. And to always push and to always strive for more, that is a challenging way in the physical, either pushing the range of motion or the complexity of a pose and the assumption that everyone might be able to do it someday if they just push hard enough, because we're all so different and no practice is going to look the same on anyone. I do think we're moving away from those things, but I think those are probably the three most glaring issues that I've wanted to address in my own teaching.
Yeah, I've noticed that a lot too, but I also do think I noticed that we are moving away from that. Like, it seems like more and more classes that I go to or take online or just hear people talking about things like listen to your body and, the kind of languaging that explains that everybody is different and that we're not striving to this particular pose. And that feels like it's just been happening maybe in the past couple decades. Yeah, it seems like what you're saying, especially in California, actually where I started really getting into yoga was in California, and it was an Ashtanga class, and I experienced kind of all those things that you're talking about. Like, it was fast and it was all about kind of pushing your body into these positions, and everybody was kind of expected to go for all these positions. And so I'm seeing all those trends that you mentioned. And I think what I see you doing is like the main theme for me is about when yoga is an expression of embodiment and coming from that inner intelligence, those rules are kind of not even applicable. And I guess so, I guess before we go on, I think that we should maybe even define embodiment. And so I'd love to hear you talk about that. What is embodiment?
Yes. I love this question because I've, played with it for so many years, and I see two streams. One is how you are in the outer world. Are you living your values and walking your talk? And what influence do you have on others and in your life? Like, what do you bring into the world? And then the other is really that personal relationship to your felt sense. And that sounds so simple, but it's such a subtle conversation that's constantly happening. So our ability to tune into bodily sensations and read them correctly, like understand what they're really saying and know what we need every day in any moment and how that's always changing. And so I actually feel that embodied practice in yoga is really after that. And then when you find that that communication is really flowing, then the forms are formless. You know, I know we both have been so influenced by Pranavinyasa and Shibare, and she really gave me the permission to go beyond the form and to that place of sahaja or the spontaneous intelligence unfolding. And I know for myself, when I'm really, really tuned in to my own body processing life, because we're designed to digest, as you know, through Ayurveda, all of our experiences within our body, mind, and emotions and heart. And it really comes through movement. And so to me, it's imperative to have some kind of mindful embodied practice at any level, and movement, whether or not it is in that same bucket. Movement can be hiking, and you don't have to be meditating the whole time. To be able to keep that conversation with our authentic, deepest self flowing and available to us.
Okay, beautiful. I guess it would be nice for listeners to like I'm imagining giving them a scenario or like an example of the kind of like the difference between kind of the yoga trends we were talking about in terms of maybe an example of like how somebody would be taught, say like Warrior One in kind of like this overly forceful kind of perfectionist approach, and then like maybe give some examples of how you teach it now, or like, yeah, some of the cues you give. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Oh, I love this. This is fun, especially audio to describe it.
Yeah.
I do think there's a lot of cues that we are thankfully evolving away from. So some of the old cues were very forceful against the design of our body. So if we were in Warrior One and we were really, really trying to square our hips to the front, that would be distorting the flow of force through the pelvis and the hips, perhaps down through the legs. And it's all a matter of degree. So it's a little bit of about this, you know, the strictness and the perfectionism that comes both from inside of our intention and the type of teacher that we might be listening to. So I would, number one, really loosen the cues. So I wouldn't really say anything about your hips. We're facing forward. So I use words like that that are a little bit more open to physical interpretation, so everybody's body can organize. I also love to create variety in simple ways. So we could lift our arms in infinite types of ways. And so, as we know in Pranavinyasa, we do pulsation and rhythmic vinyasa, where we are moving in between things. So, in a simple reaching up and then bowing with the breath, I would inspire people to be curious and look for different ways to lift their arms and what feels best to them and what feels the most whole and the most free and satisfying to them. I'm also really passionate about the eyes as the top of the spine. So, via the occipital nerve to the occipital region of the brain and the top of the spinal cord, there's truly a material highway from our eyes. And we are navigating the world, you know, mostly through sight. And if you could look at child development, a lot of the patterns of motion come through curiosity of engaging with the world through where your head is turning. And so making sure that we're really following the flow of the overall wholeness of the shape through our eyes is really important to me. And
Oh.
then the last thing is one way to assess if movement is well organized through the whole body is that you have lots of entries and exits, lots of ways in and out. So I would play with, similar to lifting the arms in different ways, getting in and out in different ways, getting in from stepping back, getting in from coming from the ground, getting in from a balance, coming in and out in different ways.
Okay, yes, and I love that. And I want to go back to the eyes thing.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, explain more, or like what would be some ways you would approach our eyes in something like Warrior One?
Yeah, so I'm sure you and I, but maybe the listeners are familiar with the concept of drishti, the gaze, the focus point. And I was always taught that drishti was for our mind, and it is, but that we found one point while we were in a pose to really focus in on. I still believe that to be true. And I'll add that since my partner is a Sanskritist, Chris Tompkins, I have some little tidbits about some of the other meanings for certain words. And drishti is related to the word dhruva, that DR root. Dhruva is another name for axis, and it's another name for the North Star, and had to do with seafaring, you know, navigation. And the North Star stays put, and it looks like everything spins around it. And so it was an active focus. It was a focus that changed, and you were always navigating towards the same place, but it wasn't like holding still. And this idea of the eyes as the top of the spine brings so much more of this kind of fullness or expansion in my experience to any pose, but especially in back bending and back extension and twists. So that, like a twist, for example, I would look, but look up in the diagonal, like you're going up a spiral staircase, and you can feel that and you can see it in bodies come through the whole spine a little bit more than kind of staying on one plane in the horizontal plane, because we're made to move in a volume. And what I see happening is like there's a disconnect at the neck often. And I think it's a bit of a relation to our tech world and our phones in particular.
Oh, yeah.
And so I find that the eyes too, because as you know, from an Ayurvedic standpoint, the digestion of what we see and the phones and the screens, there's a lot there to balance. And allowing the eyes to move in the asana when we're moving with the breath, and to find the timing that I'm like moving as I'm talking. It's hard for me to describe this. Finding the timing that keeps the neck really elongated and free and organized and out of the phone pattern, we could say. It has totally changed my own embodiment, because my neck is kind of the place I'll always be working. So it's been a huge impact for me.
Oh, okay. Me too. I mean, my neck is my thing too. And so I'm imagining now, as another example, like with a twist, because you're moving into the twist, I'm imagining you kind of starting to turn, you know, your spine, turn your belly, turn your heart. And as you're turning your head, your gaze is like actively kind of moving in that upward diagonal. Is that the idea?
Yeah. And even thinking of starting from the eyes is an interesting one. So if it really is the top of the spine, can your gaze turn your whole twist?
Oh, okay. Maybe if listeners, if you're not like driving, I'm trying that right now. I'm like starting with my eyes. And that's really nice. And it reminds me of a practice that I've adopted from you, which is kind of similar, but you're lying on the floor, like kind of spread eagle, and you're moving like from side to side in this twist, but you're moving by like starting with your one like toe. That toe starts to pull the leg over to the opposite side, and then that hip pulls your side, and that side pulls your arm. Like finally, your arm turns and you curl up in that side. And it, when you taught me that, I really experienced that feeling of how everything in the body is connected through fascia. And you talk a lot about fascia, and that experience too of like moving, starting with the eyes and letting that pull everything else, kind of reminds me of that experience of experiencing the body as this interconnected web, and where you move one part, like everything else responds. And I love how you talk about that. So I'd love to hear you like kind of, yeah, let's transition to fascia, mm-hmm. how that includes movement.
Yeah, fascia is just amazing. And the way that it is the interconnecting architecture and communication highway is really fascinating, because it's really, really closely tied to our nervous system. Truly, the body is all one, and the way that we break up the different systems is based on our way of looking. But fascia is so, so deeply related to the nervous system, and so much of embodied practice that has this self-reflective, mindful approach is speaking to feeling ourselves so we can ground our nervous system, and that all happens through the fascia. And then architecturally, we can think of it as a volume meshwork. So a lot of times it's thought of like a net or a whole bunch of lines that go through and connect head to toe. And that isn't wrong. It's like layers of our understanding as we keep evolving. And so some of the models now are more like bubbles upon bubbles upon bubbles in this volume, where force is ideally really distributed. And so like you said, you can never isolate something. When one thing changes, it has a ripple effect. Everything changes. Sometimes it's very subtle. And thinking this way, we have this term called biotensegrity for the way that our form deals with force. And biotensegrity is a combination of a word tensegrity from Buckminster Fuller, that was a combination of tension and integrity. In the body, we have our bones pushing out and our fascia pulling in. And so we're this balance of the push and the pull, or the tension and compression. And when we're moving in any movement or any pose, we want to have a balance throughout as much of the whole as possible. And I know you and I are really oriented to the concept of flow, and I find that concept so relevant in so many ways. And beyond like fluid movement, we could think of this volume meshwork being the medium in which force flows, and force and effort flows through us. And the only problems actually happen where it gets stuck. Like literally, if your joint is hitting itself over and over and over, and it's not flowing through, your literal weight or your literal force of effort. Or if, you know, you have, I usually use myself as an example, I have pretty hypermobile elbows, especially one from breaking it a long time ago. And so if I extend my arm all the way, my elbow is not straight. And you could imagine if I fell really hard, that the force would not go through my elbow. It would like maybe pull and break, you know, through the surface. Mm-hmm. And so this idea of flow through how we feel on the inside is my new way of speaking to aligning from the inside based on the latest science of fascia and biotensegrity, which I gotta say is changing so fast. We are like only at the beginning. It's really, really exciting to just imagine what in the next decade or two or more, but probably even in just the next decade, we're going to understand more about fascia being so much of the interweaving of our body and mind.
Wow. Cool. I feel like it's almost like over my head, the concept of fascia, because in my head, it's still just like this web of tissue connecting everything. But I'm like, this is going to help me expand that it's this volume. And anyway, I'm going to have to like sit with that one. But I what was coming to me to ask too was with this like new kind of understanding of this body as a whole and how important it is to be connected with all of the ways our body can move. And I mean, how important is it even to do these postures that we all know and love, or maybe don't love? I mean, like we have the warrior postures, and like we have all these named, Sanskrit postures. And there's, we see them from the outside. We know the shape. We can instruct how to get into them. How important are these postures even really?
That's such a great question. And, one of the things that I contemplate is what is our sort of subconscious assumption about where they originated? There is a few different stories, and but why that they are the ones that came down to us. Like, what is it about
Yeah.
the most common poses? I would say that, not getting too deep into the history, that yes, in the early 1900s, there was influence from Western gymnastics and wrestling in Krishnamacharya School in Mysore. And before that, in the tantric period, much before that, before Hatha Yoga, there are records in tantric texts of totally free and spontaneous movement with sound and women. And then in between there, but also having been lost, there are other records in texts of other sequences and vinyasas, and the word vinyasa is used, but they're really hard to translate well. I mean, we can not translate the words, but translate what the movement was. And I think that there is a seed of this old practice that was spontaneous was an expression of the state of yoga, and the state of yoga being one of connection in greater and greater layers, and ultimately with the all, with all of consciousness. And the movements changed and adapted depending on the person, but that the embodiment itself, the full immersion into being the doer of the movement, the sensor of the movement, and observing yourself being moved, which is such a deep teaching of this unity of the observer, the observing, and the observed all being one. That's this immersion into consciousness in the moment. And the body is such a powerful tool for that because we're the doer and the perceiver. And so these poses, I feel like depending on the person, their value is really different. Depending on our movement diet, we can think of movement just as a diet. We need to eat all kinds of different things, and our dietary needs also change through the seasons and through the seasons of life. And so depending on the person, the asanas are not all equal. And I know for myself, I was always pretty active, and I've done a lot of different sports and creative active pursuits. And when I found yoga, I dove all in for a while. That's all I did. Very intensely, I did Ashtanga as well. I don't think I knew that about you. That's kind of fun. And it set my body up in certain patterns because I was practicing those patterns because that's what I wanted. It's all a choice, right? I wanted to do these extreme poses, and I got very good at them. But because I was so focused there were other things that were less available to me in my embodied like experience. And for me personally, I want to be as versatile as possible. And so there came a point, many decades in where a lot of the asana, definitely the more complex ones, I don't feel like I need anymore. And so it all just depends. I think that anything, most of the standing poses and anything that's like squatting is so good for a world of chairs. Number one. That's one thing that has changed in my teaching as well. I sometimes hope people are okay with it, but I teach mostly standing postures. And yes, we do some seated postures. Definitely lay down on the floor, but the seated postures are far less than I used to teach because I think that in our modern world, most people are not walking as much as we're built to walk like 6 miles a day. So most people are not walking 6 miles a day, and most people are, in a chair or a desk or a car. And so the standing poses feel to me the most valuable for the most people.
Okay. Oh gosh, you're reminding me I need to walk more.
Walking is underrated. It's so good for us.
Totally. Totally. Huh. Well, and what you're speaking to too, is that, this movement practice, this embodiment practice of yoga is not really yoga. I mean, it's just one of the tools of yoga. And like you've said, yoga is so much more than that. And I'd love for you to speak about that to our audience, just that reminder, I guess, on what really is yoga and how is this embodied practice a tool of yoga?
Yes, thanks for asking that. We have so many of the issues of cultural misappropriation and how to be in a cultural appreciation and on the one hand, and definitely, modern postural yoga being fitness entirely is not the whole picture, but it also can be a way in for people. As you know, yoga encompasses so much more with Ayurveda and philosophy and ways of living and how to master our mind. And when we look back to the Yoga Sutras were really a meditation manual, how to understand this consciousness that's coming through us on a level of our thinking mind. And so I really like to frame it as yoga is a whole way of life, a whole way of orienting and seeing and living in a way that honors we are interconnected, or beyond that, we are one. Reached enlightenment where I'm feeling that all the time. But we can also translate yoga as connection. And so, how many layers of connection can we make? Can we feel our mind and body connected? Can we feel our movement and breath when it is a movement practice? Can we feel connected to other people, to the earth, to the seasons, to the world, to something greater? How wide can we experience that connection? And there are so many tools, like a big buffet of options of how, these ancient teachings have come down to us, meditation. Right living, service, bhakti, devotion, and embodied practice is but one of these tools on the buffet. And it's just a very low-hanging fruit and powerful one because of this self-sensing capacity. And I like to sort of, hope that I'm representing my appreciation and honoring of all of these cultural contexts and the lineages by changing the words that we use, because most people say, well, do you do yoga? And in their head, they're thinking a studio on a mat. And so we could say that yoga is the way of life. And yes, I do embodied yoga practice, or we could even delineate further modern postural asana or modern postural vinyasa, and that embodied yoga practice could also be movement that is not what we think of as all those poses, but done with the reverence and the mindfulness and the intention of creating connection.
Yeah. So I guess that makes me want to go back. And, you know, you mentioned it, and I guess I don't know how much you do know about the history, but I feel like curious enough to ask, especially because I didn't realize your partner is Chris Tompkins. Yeah, I don't really know him, but I know that Shiva Ray references him a lot in terms of like the history of yoga, of the postures and Sanskrit. And so what do you know? Because this is my understanding, and I want you to tell me if there's more, if it's wrong. That actually, like, the names of the postures that we use in our modern postural yoga practice, they really aren't much more than a century old. That they're like, for me, I'm always teaching, like, yeah, we learn these Sanskrit names of these asanas as a way to connect with Sanskrit, which is this ancient language, and to honor these roots, this lineage of yoga. But actually, let's not get too hung up on the forms and the names, because, like, as far as I can tell from the research I've done, we don't see Virabhadrasana, like Warrior One, and we don't see, Ustrasana, the camel pose, anywhere in ancient texts. But we do see, like you were saying, reference to movements and, like, as an expression of unity and life. But do we actually see any of these common yoga postures anywhere past like the 19th century in history?
Yeah, well, I will share what I know, and also it is probably not the whole story. For sure, we're learning as much going forward in research as going back and uncovering different ways and different perspectives of historical past. But what I have learned as the oldest known reference to physical embodied movement in the yoga lineage was in the tantric period, which was a 1,000-year period, which is often not mentioned in a lot of standard yoga teacher training or history courses. And the core tantric practice was a sonic ritual, a mantra practice, where they were working with vibration. And over in multiple texts, it's described that this mantra practice would bring them to the state of yoga where then they spontaneously moved and were moved by the sound. And part of this daily ritual included prostration, which we know Shiva is very dedicated to bringing back the power of pranam as a practice, bowing to the earth. And so we could say that might have been the first asana, as really this gesture from the heart, you know, gesture of devotion and surrender. And in this tantric practice where they were spontaneously moved, I kind of imagine it like ecstatic dance, you know, when you're just so beyond your ego mind and you're being moved by the life force. And they kind of weaved it, or it got woven with prostration around a mandala practice space. And this is related to the origins of sun salutations, of Surya Namaskara. They originated with sound. And it's interesting, some of these threads came through in different schools that are existent today. So there are this Surya Namaskara with sound still exists in the Bihar school, but not very many other places. Shiva also taught it sometimes with the solar seed mantras. Mm-hmm. And then there were a bunch of texts that had names, some of the names that we have today, but we're not really sure if they're the same poses. So there's movement happening, but you're not really sure what. There's a lot of animals. There's a lot more animals than we have today, but even the ones today, like, we're not sure it's the same actual movement. There is plank and chaturanga. They call them dandas. There's a lot of poses that are called dandas that are making the body like a stick, but it's kind of a general term. So then the danda poses were more than just one pose. And then because of religious differences with Muslim invasion and Islam, and primarily with British colonialism, not really having, they couldn't really control people who were having this ecstatic freedom as their like core being. Now this was spread all over, but it was not the majority all over India. Most of this outward practice and the texts got either destroyed or kind of hidden away. And you know, there's not very many people who have seen them or have had access to them, much less can translate them in some, you know, rare Sanskrit scripts and such things. And it's really going to take, again, some more time and up and coming scholars, like more people, to kind of dig into this. But I think that there were some of similar poses because there are drawings, but the names are not necessarily following them through.
Okay. And so basically that makes me think that those texts, if they have these pictures or if there's these names of animals, but they're clearly not accompanied with any sort of like cues as we use today. It's not like they're saying like, put your knee over your ankle here and put your leg at a 90 degree angle here. And, you know, so there was none of that clarity in how to do these postures. And so that brings me back to that question of, like, how important is it that we fit into these certain shapes as we see them, you know, in photos? And how do we, like, I guess I'm thinking, like, because it's so beautiful to get so, like, so expansive and so, like, varied, like, in terms of moving like a dance. But then at the same time, I also feel the value of like putting myself in certain positions that do balance and strengthen, you know, certain muscles, especially functionally, like ways that strengthen my biggest muscles and strengthen my core and like the poses that stretch the places that I'm tight. And there's a value in knowing the, you know, the ways, the asanas that get me there. So I guess this is a long-winded question, but... Just how you would, like, say you were, because I know you're involved in 200-hour teacher trainings, like, how would you approach these, a 200-hour teacher training, like, teaching people to teach? How would you help them understand, like, what's important in terms of these structures and what's not, and what is most important there?
Yeah. Well, one more thought about the history came to mind is that in between this time, I've been taught that in the old, very old days of Hatha Yoga, there would be a one-to-one relationship of student to teacher, and the teacher would describe a pose, but not really show you any details and tell you to go practice it for 2 months and then come back and tell him what you learned about yourself. And I think that in the context of, say, a 200-hour training, I try to really impress that the real core intention that we're here for is that learning about ourselves is that felt sense of listening to the body and knowing how to hear it, because I think our world can be so disconnected. That's one of the biggest values we can give people as a teacher. And then as far as, you know, the strengthening different muscles and the forms of the poses, I think there's two things. And the first one may be simpler, so I'll go there first, is that we are all different. We have different movement diets, but we do all mostly live in the same world. And so if we're teaching, that's where I look to say, well, what can we do most for the patterns of modern life? What are the muscles and the patterns that we're missing? What are the things that we do too much of? What's the counterpose to life? And then strengthen those things in the class. And now then as in the individual, I think it's still really, fun, and we have to keep ourselves engaged in a way that is, interesting and inspiring, and in some way, growing us. And so challenge is not a bad thing. It's just the right type of challenge, and to not get stuck into thinking that it's only always challenge. And then the other thing that I think bears attention is that there is this subconscious assumption that we're learning the alignment to stay safe. And the history of alignment is really interesting too, because in that Krishnamacharya early 1900s, one of his students was BKS Iyengar, and BKS Iyengar became Krishnamacharya's demonstration student. And they traveled around to bring more awareness to the embodied yoga practice. Even in India, it had kind of gotten a little sidetracked or lost. And so Iyengar was then an object on display, and he started to describe where he was based on where his limbs were in space. Now, I have no doubt that Iyengar had consciousness in like the tip of his pinky fingernail. It was definitely there in his own body. But then fast forward to the first yoga teacher training in Los Angeles at Yoga Works. I don't have the year on the top of my head. Probably the 60s. The yoga was starting to grow, and they realized they needed more teachers. But up until that point, becoming a teacher was like many years of own practice and observation. And the observation is kind of seeing the way energy is flowing, the way the action is balanced, right, in a person. And they had to make a yoga manual, and they brought BKS Iyengar over to try to simplify down these cues of alignment. And as far as I understand, pretty much all alignment has some thread to that. No, let me say that again. All of the standard how to place yourself type of alignment, because energetic alignment from prana vinyasa is completely a different mode, and there are different forms too. And I really, really lean on energetic alignment because it is coming from the inside rather than how we place ourselves. And it's not to fault them, because any time that we like try to put on paper in a small list and simplify something that is alive and moving and changing, we're not going to get the whole story. But the idea that it keeps us safe is not always true. And so I think that that's one thing when I'm teaching. I was just teaching in a 200 hour this last weekend, and I think that the main thing to offer there, the simplest thing, is that again, we're all so different. Even our bone shapes are different. And so to give ourselves permission to play a little bit outside of the lines, like kind of color outside the lines, and to feel again, sense our body, but see if we can sense the flow of force being distributed in our body. That was a long answer.
Yeah, no, that yeah, I mean, it is all so subtle and I mean, of course, I love energetic alignment, and it feels so completely different from, like you said, the word alignment as often is used in yoga. And I would just love to hear you explain what is energetic alignment as we learn from Shiva Ray and how we practice in pranavinyasa.
The balance of the ways that energy moves, or we could get a little more practical, the balance of opposing forces. And in that balance of opposing forces or opposing actions, there is a stability and an integration, and also a freedom to be able to still move and breathe and not get stuck. We don't ever want to get stuck. We can stay out of our choice, and we still have agency to, feel that there is no end point to any place that we are really, but into any pose, that there is an enlivening that comes from the inside. And that my experience too is when we can contain these opposing forces, that we are embodying yoga, this whole of the balance of masculine and feminine and solar and lunar and active and passive and yin and yang, that we start to sense that in ourselves and can be more of an integrated on the inside and the outside and in our life.
Yeah, beautiful. It's always every time I try to explain energetic alignment, it feels like I do my best, but I always feel like I come short because it's such an internal experience. But I guess at least on the outside, what it looks like and what it might feel like, maybe for a listener who is new to it, maybe I wonder if you could like give an example of being in energetic alignment within any shape that you choose.
Yeah, so I like to think of everything as rivers on the inside or hoses. Like our spine is a river, our arms and our legs, and it's all these like tributaries. And so if we were in, I you know what, I think any pose this could work for me. I like to think of my diaphragm, which is at the lower ribs, as like this big reservoir, so that when I breathe in, I am like feeling the expansion in a 360 degree volume. And when I breathe out, I'm like squeezing the center, or the breath squeezes out and goes through all of the rivers of my body. So that means from my breath, I go down into the pelvis and up through the spine and the eyes. And then from the spine, I go also out through the arms and legs, wherever they are. So if I am in a lunge and I am twisting with my hand on the floor, so a very easy, not squeezy twist, I'll take a breath into that diaphragm. And when it moves out into the star of my body, we could say my lunge gets longer in the direction of the lunge, forward and back, and goes deeper down into the floor through my feet. And my arms extend wider, my spine extends further, and I start to push the floor and reach up to the sky, so that it's this global expansion.
Okay, I love that. Yeah, and that so that's often why, like in pranavinyasa, we do that where we inhale kind of into the engagement, even into contraction, like into our core and into our strength. And then the exhale is like expressing more deeply, radiating out. And like I can imagine, like you saying, these rivers or these channels, like we're sending the energy out in that omnidirectional direction, right?
Yeah, and
Okay.
that's just one example. I thought it was helpful to see that it's not one direction or one line, but it could be if you were standing in Tadasana.
And I guess that translates as like if I'm even thinking, I like just sitting here right now, like how can I be in energetic alignment? Just, in a regular day-to-day, like even sitting or standing, I guess, would you say those are the same principles, like of being aware of our breath and how we get into that, that duality of expansion and contraction within just regular, functional shapes that we make every day?
Yes, absolutely. Although I wouldn't put too much effort behind it, because if we're thinking our way through the day through our body, it's going to get tiring.
Mm-hmm.
Although I will say that this is the quality of what it means to move in our biotin integrity, is to feel the volume of ourselves and the fullness in a way that feels like we're expanding. And so it's global, it's omnidirectional, and because of the design of being push and pull, when we expand out, we're actually increasing slightly the pull of the tissue in on us. It's kind of like the feeling when we yawn and we're really active and we reach out, but our tissue's pulling in. And so it's ingrained, like the energetic alignment is actually already happening. And we don't have to like actively contract, because the contraction, the pulling in happens when we reach out
Okay. Yeah.
globally, in that volume kind of
Yeah.
feeling.
Yeah. Okay, great. I know, like in one of this online trainings I did with you, you mentioned a few of like the main kind of points already, such as variety. But what are some of those other kind of, I guess, important concepts that you love to teach about in terms of embodiment?
Sure, in a yoga context or any context?
Any context.
Any context? Variety is the best medicine, and we are starting with variety inside of ourselves. I have an acronym or a saying that I've sort of distilled things down to, that we're looking to listen to our felt sense for greatest contribution and distribution. So I call it felt sense, contribution, and distribution in the actual way that we sense, so that we don't want one tiny little place stretching or one place doing all the work, but we want to spread or share the effort, and also try to feel a stretch that's more of a body part. And I am very obsessed with spirals. Everything is spiraling. And so to think even a straight line has a rotation in it. All of our bones have a twist in them, the long bones. And if we can start to feel this kind of wrapping in the body, it can be quite fascinating and really integrating. I also speak to something, I love this word, called counter-chirality, which is this: we're already doing it when we're walking, or even in standard alignment, and like most of the standing poses, the asymmetrical poses, that there's a balance of the rotations of the limbs. So the external rotation of, say, the front flexed hip, and the internal rotation of like the back extended hip leg. That those dial. So it's very similar to an energetic alignment, but it's working with the spirals, spiraling in opposition, and finding where that balance is, and having fun. I did 1 year, a whole year in my 7 years of Ashtanga, I made it my focus to smile and see what happened. And it changed so much. My body opened so much. And so, to be sort of playful in our investigation, to stay really curious and question everything, but to not like playful and it's not important, but like approach with a levity and a delight and interest and curiosity.
Yes, I love that. It is so easy to get so, especially when we are trying to achieve certain shapes, or we do have a physical goal of strengthening, or it was just to feel like the face get all tight and like this serious frowning. And It does change so much when you smile, or like when you cue as a teacher people to smile. And I think that's a good thing we can all practice, or listeners can take that home, like next time you are doing an embodied movement practice, to notice what your face is doing and notice what you're doing in that smile. I love that. And you are such a playful teacher. And it's delightful to take your classes because you bring in that fun and ease and curiosity, but of course at the same time it's reverent, and the practice is an honoring of this body as this incredible intelligent and intelligence expressed.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome, and thank you for being here. And I guess yeah, maybe you can just let us know what you're up to in the world and where we can find you and what are your passion projects coming up.
Sure. Well, my website is my name, michellebouvier.com, or you can find me on the socials as Michelle Nayeli, Nayeli. I like to give the option that you can call me Michelle or Nayeli. And I have started my own school, which is kind of crazy to say because I never really thought I would do this, but I saw a hole, a gap, and a need that I didn't see happening in any yoga schools. I have a training called the Embodied Resilience Atelier that starts every spring. That's about this inner alignment with biotensegrity and the curvature of our joints. And a 300-hour yoga certification that includes that, and another training that begins in the fall that is about living yoga through Tantra and Ayurveda and teachings on the subtle body and meditation and pranayama and bringing in sort of the daily ritual aspect, but it's less about the embodiment. And there's some pop-up things here and there, but that's my main, that is where my heart and soul and blood and sweat and tears and time and Saturday nights are going into these days.
Awesome. Okay. Well, that's exciting. I want to check those things out. And I just want to thank you for giving us your time and sharing some of these near and dear teachings and concepts, which I think they're so important. I think your voice is so important in the movement world, in the yoga world. It's influencing the way I teach, and I know that it feels like it's just the beginning. And I think, yeah, I just think I'm grateful for what you're bringing, and the way it's influencing not only my teaching, but I'm sure so many people's teaching and practices. And thank you for being this light on the world of movement and helping us see things and move in new ways.
Oh, thank you for your sweet words, and you too. I love all that you're doing. I'm such a devotee of Ayurveda myself, and also feel like such a baby. And I am so inspired by the way that you bring it forth with such joy and lightness. And I'm so glad to be connected, and very honored that I'm having any small inspiration in your movement practice as well.
Thanks for listening. Thanks for being connected. I want to invite you to consider joining me for an incredible opportunity of total rejuvenation and reset this winter at my annual women's retreat, January 11th through 16th. This year we'll be going to Mexico, just a short drive from Puerto Vallarta Airport at Equilibrium Resort and Spa. And I am so excited to go to this place. It is in the jungle. We're going to be super immersed in nature. The round yoga studio is fully open to the jungle on all sides, but enclosed with mosquito netting. And we'll be having incredible daily practices of yoga and breath work, meditation, dance, sound healing. So my guest instructor is this musician that you're listening to right now in the background, Malka Russell. She is an empowering, soulful musician who is also a sound healer and ecstatic dance DJ. So throughout this week, we'll be dancing, we'll be eating well, we'll be soaking in this resort's mountain-fed mineral cold and hot springs. And we'll take a day trip to the ocean to be at the beach. Every day, we'll be getting up early to really commit to or recommit or develop a daily yoga meditation practice before breakfast. We'll have time for rest and soaking. We'll have other practices throughout the day, including the sound healings and the dance and self-massage. And I'll be teaching about Ayurveda and skincare and just all kinds of good things and just time to connect, to laugh, to make new friends, to really be present. So I encourage you to check it out. I have some spots left and I would love for you to join me. Check it out at www.awakenedheart.org. I hope to see you there.